The Teaching of the Master by Brother L.G. Sargent. Part 6, Living Under Judgment. Chapter 1, Judges or Judged, Matthew 7, verses 1 to 6. Judge not, that ye be not judged. For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye mete, it shall be measured to you again. But why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye? But considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Or wilt thou say to thy brother, Let me cast out the mote that is in thine eye, and lo, a beam is in thine own eye? Hypocrite! Cast out first the beam out of thine own eye, and then shalt thou see clearly to cast out the mote out of thy brother's eye. Give not that which is holy to the dogs, neither cast ye your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet, and turn again and rend you. With Matthew chapter 7, the sermon enters its final section, which forms a climax. Jesus has portrayed the disciple and his life in the world. He has shown that life can only be maintained by an intimate and secret communion with God. And this communion carries with it a dependence on God, which brings freedom from fear. By contrast, he has pictured the anxious and envious mind of those who compare their condition with the condition of others. Now he goes on to show the result of comparing ourselves with other men, not merely in our outward circumstances, but in our character. The perfect example of the man who constitutes himself judge in his own cause is the Pharisee in Luke 18, verses 11 to 12. With fine irony, it is said that he stood and prayed thus with himself. With himself, because he was his own standard of reference. His words were, God, I thank thee that I am not as the rest of men, or even as this publican. But both he and the repentant tax gatherer stood there and then under the scrutiny of God. And as the outcome, one of them went down to his home justified, reckoned to be righteous. But it was not the Pharisee who was thus acquitted, but the self-confessed sinner who prayed God to be reconciled to him. The parable exactly illustrates the sayings of Matthew 7, verses 1 to 5, which show from yet another angle the contrast between the righteousness of the true covenant people and the conventional righteousness of contemporary Judaism. The man who lives with God and in God lives under judgment. He is continually known to the living God, but beyond that continuous discernment by the all-seeing eyes of God, there is a final judgment to come, when sentence will be pronounced and destiny determined. The course of thought which leads to the parable of the two builders leaves no doubt that Jesus has this day of judgment in view when he says, as the tense of the verb implies, Cease from judging that ye be not judged. Judged by whom? Reverent avoidance of the divine name by using the passive voice of the verb is part of the idiom of Jesus. What he is saying is that the man who knows God's covenant and keeps it lives his whole life as one who will in that day be judged by God. Constant awareness of judgment to come may, however, have more than one effect. For a man to know that he is measured by a standard not of his own making and that in a future day his true and hidden self will be laid bare, must give seriousness and integrity to life. But there is a danger that those who so live will demand that others shall conform to their pattern. In doing this, they transfer to themselves that standard by which they have tried to test their own lives. They make themselves the measuring rule for other men. And so out of their very zeal comes the peril of censoriousness. They make themselves the judges instead of the judged. They are solicitous for the other man's welfare, and offer help in a way which they think courteous and kindly. Permit me to cast out the mote out of thine eye. But in fact their love is self-love. They do not really forget themselves and the other man's need, but their sense of superiority shines the brighter by contrast with his fault. Even if the desire to help is sincere, they will always think, it was through my strength that he overcame his weakness. But we may go further. To judge in this context cannot escape from its harsher meaning of to condemn. And to condemn is potentially to destroy. It is to do violence against a man's soul, an act not of love but of hate. And in the light of Matthew 5, verse 21 to 22, having in it the germ of murder. Why has a man who was pursuing righteousness fallen into such a slough? Little by little he has come to see the errors to which he was not prone looming large, and his own failings have dwindled. No love is so blind as self-love, and at last his vision is so blocked that his attempt at aid would be play-acting. He is like a sick man with the bearing beam of a roof across his eye, trying to remove a splinter or a bit of dried stem from someone else's. For the beam in his eye is his self-esteem. If he then measures out condemnation to others, the same measure awaits him in the day when he thinks he will be justified. The old legal principle of measure for measure has returned, not in the material realm, but the spiritual. And the man for whom it was abrogated by the command not to resist evil is himself subject to the penalty of an eye for an eye. Forgiveness of others paves the way to God's forgiveness of ourselves. Condemnation of others leads to his condemnation of ourselves. Even in little things, the self-sufficient spirit may reveal itself in continual grumbling at others' real or imagined shortcomings. And to this James applies the Lord's words, "Murmur not, brethren, one against another, that ye be not judged. Behold, the judge standeth before the door." The grumblers, like the Pharisees, are more conscious of themselves than of God. The proverbial saying about the mote and the beam is found in rabbinical writings and is an example of the caustic Jewish humour. Its picturesque hyperbole gives no difficulty to those who know the speech of the English countryside, where something small may be about as big as a bee's knee, or a very thin man like a rasher of wind. The salty idiom of unsophisticated men who live close to the soil offers the best parallel to the language of Jesus. The Lord's words have their reflection in Romans 2, verse 3. "And reckonest thou, O man, who judgest them that practice such things, that thou shalt escape the judgment of God?" Romans 14 is a sustained plea for refraining from judgment in things which can be left to the individual conscience. One man, says the apostle, may observe dietary restrictions and do it for the Lord's sake. another, equally sincere, may eat with thankfulness any food which comes. If each acts with the Lord in mind, and his mental state is vital to the argument, then to his Lord he stands or falls. Therefore, apostrophizing in turn the representatives of the opposing points of view, Paul says, "But thou, why dost thou judge thy brother?" Or thou again, "Why dost thou set at naught thy brother? For we shall all stand before the judgment seat of God." We are helped by the parallel which sets judge against set at naught. The judgment which Paul has in mind here is a condemnation which easily passes over into contempt for the brother for whom Christ died. To Paul himself, it is a very small thing that he should be subject to the scrutiny of men. He is not even his own judge, for even if he knows nothing against himself, he is not therefore justified. His examiner is the Lord. Therefore, he says, "Judge nothing before the time, until the Lord come, who will both bring to light the hidden things of darkness, and will make manifest the counsels of the heart." Judge is indeed a word of many meanings, and only the context can decide where the balance of the meaning lies in any given case. Judgment, in the sense of equitable decision, is cited by the Lord himself along with mercy and faith as the weightier matters of the law, which the scribes and Pharisees had left undone. Lydia could rightly say to Paul and Silas, "If ye have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come unto my house." If therefore judgment in the sense of condemnation of others is excluded, judgment in the sense of discernment is enjoined. The disciple has to be judicious without being judicial, a dilemma which is only fully resolved by a principle given a few verses later. For the remainder of the chapter shows progressive stages of division among men through the action of the Word of God. Even in this life, the Word puts men to a test and reveals something of their true character. And the first division is between those who have reverence for holy things and those who in their sensuality find holy things offensive. The holy thing was, under the law, the term used for food offered sacrificially, of which only the priests and their households could partake, and then only if they were ceremonially clean. On the other hand, the flesh of animals torn by beasts was forbidden altogether for food, and was to be cast to the dogs. These ritual requirements provide the terms which Jesus applies to things of the spirit. Dogs were in Jewish parlance the uncircumcised, and swine were held in special abhorrence from the time that Antiochus Epiphanes ordered them to be profanely sacrificed. But for Jesus, the distinction is not a physical one, but moral and mental. The contemporary verb quoted in 2 Peter 2, verse 22, and perhaps partly dependent on Proverbs 26, verse 11, makes dogs and swine types of the grossness of sensual human nature. Proverbs 11:22 is the only Old Testament example of swine used in a proverbial simile, and carries a like idea of ignorant sensuality. But, to quote by way of illustration only, the Syriac of Ecclesiasticus 22 verse 13 has, "Talk not much with a fool, and consort not with a pig. Beware of him, lest thou have trouble, and thou becomest defiled when he shaketh himself." This in turn recalls Proverbs 9, verses 7 and 8. "He that correcteth a scorner getteth to himself shame." and he that reproveth a wicked man getteth himself a blot. Reprove not a scorner, lest he hate thee. Reprove a wise man, and he will love thee. And compare also Proverbs 23, verse 9. Pearls of the spirit word will only evoke blasphemy from the blindly ignorant. That which is holy is not to be exposed to profanation by sensual men. Are we then to judge them and say, this one is worthy to have the word, and that one is not? By no means. It is not for us to condemn, to assess what they are in God's sight, still less to damn, to deem them outside the pale of God's mercy. What chance, then, would there be for a Saul of Tarsus at a time when he was as vicious toward the ecclesia as a thwarted pariah? Nonetheless, the truth we hold and the salvation it offers are God's gifts, and to be handled with reverence for the giver. These words do in fact impose on believers one of the most difficult discriminations they're called on to make. On the one hand, no verse is more liable to be used unwarrantably as a veil for moral cowardice or spiritual snobbery. It cannot mean that preaching is to be withheld for fear that the word should be despised. Yet it does impose a responsibility for judging the time and manner of our witness. Even in spreading broadcast the gospel of the kingdom, we can observe a decent reticence about those things which the natural man cannot receive. God forbid that we should hoard our pearls, but neither should we scatter them like garbage in the pig's trough, where they will be snouted out and trampled in the mire. There is a certain egotism in the attempt to force salvation on the unwilling and resentful. It betrays both a lack of regard for the sanctity of God and a lack of respect for the individuality of men. Only God can claim men's hearts, and he draws them without forcing them into his mould. We need to remember that while by his grace we may be agents of his word, it is God who works through it and not we ourselves. When we are most self-forgetful, we shall be at least self-assertive in our dealings with God and men, and then our work in the saving of souls from death will best stand the test of time.